From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air.
I put a spell on you. Because you're mine.
On today's Fresh Air, we go deep into our vaults for our Halloween archive edition and revive our Dracula expert Raymond McNally. Movie director John Carpenter tells us about creating a horror legend of his own, Halloween, and writer Patrick McGraw does a reading from his gothic novel, Spider. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton has arrived in Saudi Arabia for talks with King Fahd. This is the last stop on Mr. Clinton's Middle East tour. The president spent most of the day in Kuwait, where he told Kuwaitis the United States would stand with them to face any threat from Iraq. Mr. Clinton also spoke to hundreds of U.S. troops stationed in the Emirate. He thanked the soldiers for their work.
What you are doing is assuming America's burdens in this new and challenging time to maintain our national security, to maintain our national commitments, to help the world move toward peace and freedom. I hope you will always take the pride in your contributions that I see in your faces today.
The Pentagon deployed 28,000 U.S. troops to the region over the last few weeks after Iraq massed thousands of troops near its border with Kuwait. The Defense Department now says it's sending another 24 A-10 attack jets to Kuwait as an additional deterrent. Israeli officials say there's no new message of peace from Syria. Syrian President Hafez al-Assad met yesterday with President Clinton in Damascus. Mr. Clinton says Assad went beyond anything he's ever said on peacemaking, but Israeli officials say they've gone over the message Mr. Clinton brought from Syria and they found nothing new. An Israeli government spokesman says Mr. Clinton and Secretary of State Warren Christopher are mistaken if they believe progress was made. Virginia Senate candidate Oliver North says he won't get into a fight with former First Lady Nancy Reagan over the Iran-Contra affair. Kevin Hall has this report from Richmond.
Former First Lady Nancy Reagan, speaking in New York City Thursday night, said Oliver North lied to her husband and about her husband. And Mrs. Reagan said North appears to have trouble separating fact from fantasy. North refused to respond directly to Mrs. Reagan's comments, saying his mother taught him never to fight with a lady. But North says he's discussed Iran-Contra at length in a 400-page best-selling book. In it, North wrote that President Reagan knew about the secret operation to funnel money from Iranian arms sales to the Nicaraguan Contras. And North wrote his superiors ordered him to lie to Congress about it. Former President Reagan has denied both of those statements. North is locked in a tight race for the Virginia Senate seat held by Democrat Charles Robb. For National Public Radio, I'm Kevin Hall in Richmond.
The government says the economy expanded during the third quarter of this year by 3.4%. That's bigger than most economists expected. It suggests that the interest rate hikes by the Federal Reserve haven't slowed down U.S. growth as much as the central bankers had intended. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 54 points at 3,929. The Nasdaq is up almost 8 points at 775. This is NPR. A leader of the Burmese military junta has met with opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi today. She is the Nobel Peace Prize winner who's been under house arrest for the last 5 years. Suu Kyi also leads the pro-democracy opposition to the Burmese military government. The meeting between the junta official and Suu Kyi reportedly lasted for 3 hours. It was their second meeting in a month. State television and radio broadcast news of the meeting in Burma. The South Korean government survived a no-confidence vote today. This was triggered by a bridge collapse in Seoul a week ago that killed 32 people. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Tokyo.
The ruling Democratic Party controls the National Assembly by an overwhelming margin, and the opposition-led motion today to oust the Prime Minister and his cabinet was defeated by a vote of 174 to 116. Today's no-confidence measure capped a week-long political firestorm touched off by last Friday's deadly bridge disaster. Public anger over lax safety standards and slipshod engineering was made worse by a fatal ferryboat fire 4 days later that killed 29. So far, 9 officials have been charged in the bridge collapse. While the Prime Minister and his cabinet survived the latest assault, the widening investigations into both tragedies are likely to implicate more officials before the probes are through. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
Irish President Mary Robinson has met with Northern Irish politicians who have been linked to Protestant paramilitary groups. This meeting was in New York today. A spokesman for the Irish consulate says Robinson had an exchange of greetings with the 6 politicians. The Irish Constitution bars the Republic's largely ceremonial president from holding political talks, but the New York meeting was seen as strongly symbolic. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Permit me to introduce myself. I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is our special trick-or-treat archive show. Horror movies have kept alive the fear of vampires, the undead that rise at night, stalk the living, and feed on their blood. Many years ago, Terry Gross spoke with vampire expert Raymond McNally, who has studied vampires as portrayed in folklore, literature, and film. His book, In Search of Dracula, was written after he discovered the original Castle Dracula while traveling through Transylvania in 1967 on a Fulbright research grant. McNally is a professor of Romanian and Eastern European culture at Boston College. In his research, McNally discovered that Bram Stoker named the vampire in his classic novel Dracula after the 15th-century Romanian prince Vlad Dracula. The prince wasn't a vampire, but he terrorized his subjects by punishing his transgressors, by impaling them on wooden stakes, which is why he's also known as Vlad the Impaler. Raymond McNally spoke with Terry back in 1985. He told her more about Vlad's cruel and sadistic reign.
Well, he lived from 1431 to 1476, and the time period was when the Turks were moving up through the Balkans, a very turbulent period. And it was a very cruel period, too, in which he lived. As a child, he was given as a hostage to the Turks by his own father on the promise that the father, who was named Dracul, would not go to war with the Turks. And what did the father do? Father turned right around and went to war with the Turks, while his own son was held there hostage. Now, my assumption on that is, look, if I was left by my own father among these Turks as a hostage, and I hear my dear old dad has gone to war violating the treaty, thereby putting my life in jeopardy, I think life is pretty cheap as a teenager if that's the way your own father treats you. So it was a rough time. Then when he came to the throne, his brother had been buried alive by the gentry, the boyars, and his father had been assassinated. It's a rough time. So it's no wonder he took vengeance initially. But then he pushed it far beyond that. He was, frankly, a sadistic kind of cruel person.
Can you describe a little bit the torture that he became known for?
Well, impaling is, of course, a lost art, fortunately, for most of us. The classic way of impaling is to take the victim, tie one horse to one leg, one horse to the other leg. The victim is on the ground. Take a stake or pole, oiled, rounded at the end. That's important so it won't pierce your innards. It's inserted in you. Slowly the horses move forward and you're hoisted up on it and you die slowly from exposure to the elements. Very cruel way and slow way to die.
Okay, this Vlad the Impaler, also known as Dracula, was terribly sadistic, but he wasn't a vampire.
No, he wasn't. His story, you know, he was a horror figure, basically, real horror. And his story was very, very popular in the late 15th century in Leningrad. And I looked at this manuscript which talks about him in Russia. This manuscript was made in several copies. It's well known. And then there were some German stories about him in manuscript written by monks and also pamphlets. So his reputation spread around a great deal as a horror figure, as someone who was cruel. They often added this business of cruel, but just given the time period, tough time period, he took extreme measures. I don't agree with that, but that's the explanation that's usually given.
How do you think the Bram Stoker novel connected to Dracula, because there's a whole other body of vampire folklore which we'll talk about.
Yeah.
But Bram Stoker used the name of Dracula, who you've researched, and he wasn't a vampire.
No, that's correct. What happened is Bram Stoker was impressed with a story called Carmilla, written by another Irish author, Sheridan Le Fanu, which is a very bizarre story, actually, for that period, the Victorian period. It's a vampire story with kind of quasi-lesbian overtones, undertones, and things like that. Anyway, that story impressed Bram Stoker. He wanted to write a vampire story himself. He wasn't sure where he was going to set it. Then, in a book by Emily Gerard, he came across the whole chapter on Transylvanian superstitions. And there he found all the material for his vampire folklore, which is all authentic Transylvanian folklore. He did not make up anything. Garlic, all that business, is the stake through the heart, he took that in. So he incorporated that. So often, and then he came across the legend of the Blood Countess, this Elizabeth Báthory. You remember in the novel, which you don't see in the movies, when Count Dracula first appears, he has a white mustache and white hair. He's an old man in the novel, unlike Frank Langella or Christopher Lee. They all look young. No. And then as he gets the blood treatments, his hair turns iron gray, darker, his cheeks turn ruddy. So it's the blood for cosmetic purposes to make you look younger and younger. Now that he got from this story she read about of Elizabeth Báthory. There were a couple of pages about her in this book of werewolves written by Sabine Baring Gould, who is most remembered for his rousing hymn, Onward Christian Soldiers. But anyway, he wrote a book on werewolves, too. And in that, he talked about this Elizabeth Báthory, who did these, butchered 650 girls in order to bathe and shower in their blood, because she had this notion that this kept her skin looking white and young, like the skin of the girls. So he took that whole business of the blood for rejuvenation purposes, and connected that all up with the folklore. As you know, in a character in a novel is never an historical personality. Every author worth his or her salt always, you know, makes a composite, a little bit from here, a little bit from there, and that's what happened here. He took various elements from various places and put it all together to create one of the most famous vampires of all time, Count Dracula.
Now, you mentioned that all the folklore in Bram Stoker's book is accurate. Let's talk about that folklore and see what you found out about where it comes from. According to folklore, who becomes a vampire?
Well, let's clarify what we mean in the folklore by a vampire. A vampire is a walking corpse, a resuscitated body. So right away, it is not a ghost. That's important. It's not an apparition. It's not something floating out there and it's going to appear somewhere else or transmigrate or something of that sort. No, it's a corpse. It's reanimated, according to the folklore, by the source of life itself, in the folklore, blood.
And who becomes a vampire?
Well, according to the folklore, it's a little complicated. Someone who's a werewolf. A werewolf is someone, of course, who believes that he or she has become a wolf. A werewolf can become a vampire upon death. Anyone who's led a violent life. In the Christian civilization, children who die unbaptized. Then the seventh son of a seventh son is doomed. In certain parts of Transylvania, someone who's born with blue eyes and red hair is thought, because it's rare, you understand, you know, they're usually dark-haired and have dark eyes, so, you know, the bizarre is often taken to be the fearful thing, or so that's the sort. Or, of course, the usual way is if a vampire infects you during life. And that occurs in a very specific way. It's not the way it is in the movies, you know, the bite on the neck and that sort of thing. The vampire must mix his or her blood with yours. You must drink the blood of the vampire so that your blood content changes. And so when you die, you will become united with that vampire in physical immortality, and you must, to prolong your existence, drink the blood of the living.
Is there any pattern in the folklore to who the vampire is likely to use as his prey?
Definite pattern. That's a very important question, too, because vampires never, generally, attack strangers. They always attack members of the immediate family or those with whom they have been intimate in life. Only after they have taken care of the immediate family and friends and lovers and so on, do they branch out. Now, what goes on there is something psychologically very, very profound, I think. If someone you love dies, you don't want them dead, do you? If you really love them, you're sorry they're gone. You wish they were back with you. That's a very, very old tendency, you know. So there is this immediate wanting to have them back, you see, so that when, as it in their minds anyway, this person comes back from the dead, and the initial reaction is, wow, how great to see you, wonderful, you know, I'm so happy, you're not dead, you're back. Then, though, comes the fear. What is that creature going to be like who has gone through the experience of death? Will it be as human as we are, or will it be something different? And will it, of course, try to lure us into communion with it? And we know what that means. The only way you can join together with someone who has died is to become dead yourself, to go into the land of the dead, and that is the fear element. So that element, that's very strong in those all those folklore stories, this attraction and then fear.
There are also, in the movies and in the folklore, ways to repel a vampire with a cross or with garlic.
Yes.
What's the significance of that?
First of all, let's take the oldest weapon is, of course, garlic. And garlic is a medicinal plant. Peasants use it to ward off disease. Anything that wards off disease is thought to have magical qualities and hence can ward off evil, such as werewolves, vampires, devils, and so on. So that's that element. Now, in a Christian civilization, they use it as the cross, because the cross is identified with the force of good and the vampire is identified with the force of evil. In other civilizations, they use other religious symbols. So that's the... It can only ward off the vampire, of course. These symbols are not good to destroy the vampire, just ward him or her off. Vampires, of course, can be male or female. I think that's rather important. They're one of the few night creatures capable of sex.
That's interesting, because you can never, in the movies, well, it depends on the movies. In the Hammer movies, they have sex.
Oh, yeah, and how?
In some of the American movies, they just get bitten on the neck.
It's an erotic experience, I would say. I mean, that's, in the novel, it certainly is.
Is that part of
folklore,
too?
It's kind of oral
too?
Sex, after all. I mean, that's what it boils down to. I mean, the vampire is biting, is mixing, you know, having someone else, drink his blood. That's what that's all about.
We talked a little bit about sexual imagery in the vampire folklore. There's a lot of religious imagery.
Oh, there certainly is.
In it as well.
Yes, it's a kind of antichrist figure, this vampire. Why? Well, first of all, it promises what all of us who love life want. Eternal life. But of course, eternal life, we don't want that. And if we're going to get old, do we? Who wants that? Right? You want eternal life where you can remain physically young. And that is the promise. A great promise. Physical immortality and to remain young and healthy. So there's that element. And the ceremony itself. You know, what are the two great taboos in modern civilization? One is, we do not eat human blood anymore, and we do not eat human flesh. Those are taboo. They're basically antisocial behavior, right? Because if we were to allow that to go on, somebody's blood has to be drunk. Some one of us has to be drunk, and some one of us has to give up our bodies to be eaten. However, in several major religions, this is done symbolically. You become one with the divinity by doing what is technically taboo. You drink the blood of the Savior and you eat his flesh. You commit vampirism and werewolfism. And you join. It is communion. Well, this is a kind of unholy communion. You drink the blood of the vampire, you become one with the vampire, you acquire physical immortality at a great price. But of course, immortality is usually, there's a price tag attached to it. So what I think the appeal of the story is, say, oh, wow, to live forever and to be young, wonderful. But then sour grapes.
Have you ever come across a story where you suspected there might be a real vampire in the classical undead sense?
Yes, one. When I was in Transylvania, I was at the foot of Castle Dracula, and I met a woman there named, her name was Tinka. She's one of the local villagers. And she told me that her father had died. This was 30 years before. She was telling me about something that happened 30 years before when her father died. And he was laid out to rest, and in that part of the world, as in other parts of the world, they keep the corpse in the house for 2-3 days before they put it in the ground. They noticed after 3 days that the skin was still pliable. Rigor mortis had not set in. And the cheeks bore a ruddy complexion. So the blood hadn't calcified. Signs of the vampire, the undead. So she told me she knew what had to be done, but she couldn't do it because, after all, it was her father's body, and she couldn't bring herself to do it. But the villagers went ahead and did it, and they did what is done in all the horror movies. They drove a wooden stake through the corpse, and then as an added insurance, they burned the body.
Are there still places like Transylvania where the legends are circulating and people still live in fear of it?
Oh, yes, definitely. I visited places. With members of the Institute of Folklore, I went up into the mountains with a tape recorder, and we sat down with the peasants, and if you do it correctly, you have to talk about the crops. You know, you can't just walk up to peasants and say, hey, how about vampires or something? Peasants will lie to you, and peasants are not stupid. It's a wrong assumption on the part of many city people, you know, say, oh, these stupid peasants, they're not stupid, they're very clever oftentimes. You have to get their confidence. You talk about the peaches and the cows and all, and then you start asking them a little bit about, well, what do you know about the history of this place and so on? Have you ever heard of anything like a walking dead, an undead? And then they will open up once they know you're not making fun of them, and the belief is very much alive there.
Terry Gross spoke with Dracula expert Raymond McNally back in 1985. McNally is a professor of Romanian and Eastern European culture at Boston College. More from our Halloween archives after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Sixteen years ago in the Halloween season, moviegoers watched a teenage babysitter played by Jamie Lee Curtis protect herself against a psychotic murderer. John Carpenter's movie Halloween was a low-budget thriller that was a huge box office success, so successful that Hollywood couldn't resist going back for 5 sequels, although Carpenter lost interest after producing Halloween's 2 and 3. Carpenter's other films include Escape from New York, the remake of The Thing, and Memoirs of an Invisible Man. Terry Gross spoke with John Carpenter in 1988.
I think in a lot of ways Halloween was an exercise in building suspense. And let me just play a short clip from the movie. This is a clip of Jamie Lee Curtis. And by the way, this is her first really big film role. And in the credits it says, introducing Jamie Lee Curtis. The way the story builds is first she thinks maybe that somebody's following her. And by the end she knows it's true and that she's being attacked. So here she is, running from house to house, screaming for help. Some of the things that you learned in making Halloween about how to make the audience nervous, how to get them worried about the character's well-being, how to build suspense?
Well, you first have to start with the story. You have to have a story that involves a certain amount of suspense in terms of the characters, the antagonist and the protagonist being on a collision course. Their destinies are going to cross. You know eventually that whatever represents evil in your film is going to have to rear its ugly head and come after you. And your job in a thriller like this is to get the audience to identify with the victim. And Jamie being our focus of identity, we can begin to feel her panic and running away from this kind of ultimate evil that's after her. And I think once you have that kind of a setup, well, you can then begin to build suspense in the audience. Now, suspense really simply means anxiety. The audience is anxious about what's going to be seen, what's going to be coming up. Whenever Jamie would walk into a dark room, perhaps, they'd say, "But don't go in there. Can't you go someplace else?" They're putting themselves into the character. They're trying to tell her to watch out. I think that's the primary idea in Halloween in terms of building suspense.
And the audience knows just a little bit more than the characters do about what's happening. So they know about the danger she's about to get into.
Well, in general, they know that he's out there, because they've known that since the beginning of the film. What they don't know is exactly where he is. So the audience is also waiting in suspense for, when is he going to jump out of the dark? I know it's going to come, because this is a horror film, and they always do this kind of thing, don't they? So now we're walking in a dark room. It's kind of dark in here. Well, now, where will he be? And the longer that you can wait and let the audience imagine where he might be, and then all of a sudden have him spring out, the more in suspense they will be.
You know, Ebert and Siskel, the film reviewers, have something that they call the idiot plot, that a lot of horror movies hinge on the main character doing something absurdly stupid. Like, for instance, the character's running, and they just slowly walk away with their back turned, where if they could have ran away really quickly if they were thinking. Do you think that there's a lot of idiot-type plots in suspense films, and is it easy to get around that?
Well, I think that what they're talking about is something that's done intentionally. For instance, in the Friday the 13th movies, the idiot plot was basically invented in order to get the audience to participate. Because if you have a teenager walking into a room, and they turn their back on the danger and wander through kind of innocently, the audience feels superior to the character, and they can start screaming, "You idiot, why don't you get out of there?" And in being superior to the characters, as soon as the incredibly evil and powerful boogeyman steps out, then they can laugh in derision and say, "Oh, I told you so. If you'd only listened to me, it would have saved your life."
Have you seen the movies that came after Halloween that were in part inspired by it? Prom Night, Fright Night, the Friday the 13th movies?
I really didn't have the heart to see them. I've seen occasionally glance at them on television, but they... what bothers me about a lot of horror films is that I don't think they're made by people who have a feeling for the story they're telling. I would say to the audience that there are certain directors who are extremely committed to the genre they're working in, David Cronenberg and George Romero, as two examples. Those filmmakers who feel and have a personal point of view to express in this particular genre. A lot of the movies that copy other films are simply trying to utilize the technique without the heart. And in that sense, I wouldn't recommend them.
Terry Gross spoke with movie director John Carpenter in 1988. I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Bloody hands, bodies, and moving walls used to be the images in writer Patrick McGraw's gothic stories, but now he relies more on psychological terror to quicken the pulse of his readers. Coming up, we talk to Patrick McGraw about his writing, and he'll give a reading from his novel, Spider, told in the voice of a schizophrenic. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Woody Allen's new comedy, Bullets Over Broadway. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton is now in Saudi Arabia, where he'll meet King Fahd. Topping their agenda will be the security of the Persian Gulf region. Mr. Clinton will tour a large Saudi military complex just a few miles from the Iraqi border. There's a report that the president will ask the king to station U.S. military equipment there in case U.S. forces are hastily deployed in the Gulf region again. Diplomats say Kuwait and Qatar have already agreed to such an arrangement. Mr. Clinton stopped off in Kuwait briefly today to greet American troops stationed there. He hinted there's a chance that some of the troops could be home by Christmas. The government says the economy expanded by 3.4% in the third quarter of this year. The Commerce Department says the growth was due to increased consumer spending. Analyst Hugh Johnson says that's more than double the previous quarter's report.
The most important number is that we saw an increase or a recovery, shall we say, from the first and second quarters in spending by individuals, and that was led by spending on things such as clothing and automobiles. So there's no question that the consumer is back, despite the fact that we've seen relatively high interest rates.
Some analysts are predicting that the Federal Reserve Board may have to hike interest rates yet again this year. International human rights monitors say despite the U.S. military's presence in Haiti, there are still problems in disarming paramilitary Haitian groups. Mike O'Connor reports from Port-au-Prince.
The human rights monitors are from the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, part of the Organization of American States. They say in their study of conditions since the U.S. military arrived, there are many clear improvements. In urban areas, they say, people feel far more free to show their support of President Aristide. But in the rural parts of Haiti, in places where the U.S. has yet to establish a strong presence, the monitors say there are reliable reports that repression continues. They say there is still a serious problem with the paramilitary groups which worked with the Haitian army. In many areas, these paramilitary groups have not been disarmed. The commission estimates that only a small number of the weapons distributed by the Haitian army to its supporters have been confiscated, and says that in some parts of the country, the political bosses imposed by the military are still in power. For National Public Radio, this is Mike O'Connor in Port-au-Prince.
Democrats are pointing to new polls that show better approval ratings for President Clinton. Treasury Secretary Lloyd Benson says the surveys reflect voters' better attitudes about an improving economy. But the chairman of the Republican Party says the Democrats were going to bounce back a little from bad ratings anyway. Chairman Haley Barbour isn't impressed by new polling data. On Wall Street, stock prices closed sharply higher today. The Dow Jones Industrials gained more than 55 points to end the day at 3,930. This is NPR. An explosion at a Conoco oil refinery near Lake Charles, Louisiana, has apparently killed one worker. A local television station says Conoco has confirmed that one person died as a result of this morning's blast. A Conoco spokeswoman says three people have been hospitalized for minor burns. The explosion apparently occurred in the refinery's catalytic cracking unit as it was being started up. General Dynamics has agreed to pay more than $5 million in back wages to more than 1,000 workers in its electric boat division. It's one of the biggest settlements in history. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The Labor Department says the workers were illegally denied overtime payments when General Dynamics mistakenly tagged some jobs as exempt from federal overtime law. Labor Department investigators found that the company misapplied criteria used to determine who, among its professional employees, was exempt from the overtime provisions of the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act. Department officials say they aren't allowed to reveal whether their probe was the result of a routine check of company records or if it was the result of an employee having blown the whistle on General Dynamics. The agreement is one of the largest back pay overtime awards in Labor Department history, but not as big as last year's $16.2 million award against Food Lion. The award covers electric boat employees at installations stretching from Connecticut to Washington State. Eligible workers will receive their money by December 1st. Current employees will be paid by the company, and those who've retired or left General Dynamics will receive their money through the Labor Department. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
Police in Zurich, Switzerland are reporting a second major art theft in less than a week. Authorities say five paintings by Raphael, Van Dyck, and Brouwer have been taken from a private collection. A Swiss newspaper quotes an art expert who says the stolen Raphael might not be genuine. Seven Picassos were stolen last week from another private Zurich gallery. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. For those of us drawn to tales of madness, violence, and perversity, there's a substantial tradition of Gothic fiction. Poe, Kafka, and Mary Shelley all employed some of the imagery and melodrama of the Gothic form. Patrick McGraw is a writer who's updated the genre. He's the author of a collection of short stories, Blood and Waters and Other Tales, and the novels The Grotesque, Spider, and Dr. Haggard's Disease. Terry Gross talked with McGraw in 1990 around the publication of Spider. McGraw explained how his writing had moved away from the bizarre and supernatural towards the psychological.
Spider is very much a portrait of a schizophrenic, and whatever elements of the macabre, the perverse, the grotesque that are contained within that book are very much a function of a psychotic mind breaking down rather than, in any sense, pieces of gratuitous horror for their own sake.
Let me ask you for your comparison of Gothic versus New Gothic fiction.
Well, I think the traditional Gothic did lay a lot of stress on the furniture, on the dripping caves and the mouldering mansions on the top of hills and dark forests. There's a great stress on the props and the sets. We no longer need those props and sets in order to depict the sorts of characters that inhabited those sorts of locations, and now we can simply depict the mind itself, and it doesn't have to be accompanied by clanking chains and gloomy fortresses and so on. So I think the Gothic is now much more exclusively a psychological sort of condition.
You joined us a couple of years ago on Fresh Air when your collection of short stories was published, and our listeners might remember that you grew up near the gate of an institution for the criminally insane in London, and your father was the medical superintendent there. How does that figure specifically into your new novel, Spider?
As a result of growing up the son of my father, I was equipped with a fairly thorough grounding in mental illness as a small boy. I later worked in his hospital and in another hospital in Canada, and so I got to know at first hand what schizophrenia looks like and other forms of mental illness. When I came to write fiction, I found that this formed a sort of a reservoir of knowledge that I more and more have been able to draw on, which has culminated in this latest novel, which is really centrally a depiction of schizophrenia from a first-hand account of schizophrenia.
I believe your father is retired, but did you show him the manuscript, and did he give you any advice?
Yeah, I would show him the manuscript in various early drafts, and he was very quick to tell me what was plausible and what was not in what I was depicting as, you know, as a schizophrenic condition. In fact, when I wanted to actually have a relatively a gentle ending to the novel, he told me that this, in fact, was not plausible, that the schizophrenic's fate is generally a rather grim one. So he did push me in the direction of you know, not shying away from the full sort of ghastly horror that schizophrenia is.
What are the considerations when you're writing a book and the narrator is mentally unbalanced, like in your book?
This was the great technical challenge here, was to contain the incoherence and the wildness of madness within the order and the continuity that, that the novel form demands. And I don't know if I can quite put my finger on how I solved that problem, but a lot of it has to do with, I think, using different time frames. And Spider is always in... he is referring back to his childhood, he's referring to the present, and he's also referring to his period in mental hospital. So there's three times that are occurring simultaneously within the novel, and I found that if I moved between these three times, I could, when Spider began to sort of drift off into the more wild areas of his illness, I could... bring us back by moving to a different, you know, he would perhaps begin to talk about the present and what he was experiencing in the present as a way of reining us in and giving us once more the sense of where the narrative's going.
When a narrator is schizophrenic, like the character who narrates your novel, the reader really doesn't know how much to trust him.
No, not at all. So the reader has to almost read a second text beyond the one that's in front of him. You have to, in some way, second-guess Spider and understand by what principle he is constantly distorting what it is that he's reporting to you. And once you catch that principle, then you can begin to really interpret what he's telling. You say, no, I know this is not true, but I understand that when he says... when he says this, what he means is this, because I've begun to see, you know, the ways in which he contradicts himself and the sorts of anomalies there are in his account.
Writer Patrick McGraw speaking with Terry Gross in 1990. Coming up, a reading from McGraw after this short break. This is Fresh Air. And now Patrick McGraw reads us an excerpt from his novel, Spider.
Our narrator in this passage is a strange, sad, solitary figure called Spider. Now, after an absence of 20 years, Spider returns to the slums of the East End of London, where he grew up, and moves into a seedy boarding house run by the indomitable Mrs. Wilkinson. In this passage, he'll recall memories of his father, Horace, a plumber, and of his long-suffering mother. I haven't even told you my name yet. It's Dennis, but my mother always called me Spider. I am a baggy, threadbare sort of a customer, really. My clothes have always seemed to flap about me like sailcloth, like sheets and shrouds. I catch a glimpse of them sometimes as I hobble through these empty streets, and they always look vacant, untenanted, the way the flannel flaps and hollows about me, as though I were nothing, and the clothes were clinging merely to an idea of a man, the man himself being elsewhere, naked. These feelings disappear when I reach my bench, for there I am anchored. I have a wall behind me and water in front of me, and as long as I don't look at the gasworks, all is well. But I had a bit of a shock yesterday, for I discovered that nothing fit me any more. I noticed it first when I got up from the bench. My trousers barely reached the tops of my ankles, and from the ends of my sleeves, my wrists were poking out to an absurd length, like sticks, before flowering suddenly into these long, floppy hands of mine. When I arrived back at the house, everything seemed to have returned to normal, and it occurred to me that the problem might be with my body rather than my clothes. Of course, I wouldn't think of speaking to Mrs. Wilkinson about any of this. She has already made her views clear on the subject. She has forbidden me to wear more than one of any article of clothing at any one time, no more than one pair of trousers, one shirt, one jersey, and so on, though naturally I defy her on this, as I like to wear as many of my clothes as I can. I find it reassuring, and since returning from Canada, reassurance is something I'm simply not getting enough of. Probably the whole thing was just some sort of perceptual error. I have occasionally been troubled this way in the past. I'm a much taller man than my father was, but in other respects I resemble him. He was wiry and short-sighted. He wore round, horn-rimmed spectacles that made him appear owlish. His eyes had a deceptively mild, watery sort of look to them, and when he took his spectacles off, you realised what a startlingly pale blue colour they were. But I've seen those eyes of his fire up with anger, and when that happened, there was nothing mild and watery about him at all, and as often as not, I'd be taken down the coal cellar and feel the back of his belt. Not that he'd let anyone else ever see his anger. He was much too careful for that. But my mother and myself, we saw it. He had no other outlet for it. We were the only people in the world weaker than he was. I remember my mother used to say, "Run down the dog, Spider, and tell your father his supper's on the table." And that's when I knew I'd see that furious pale light come up. The dog was the pub on the corner of Kitchener Street, the Dog and Beggar. It was not a big pub. There were four rooms, the public bar, the saloon bar, and two small snugs where private conversation could be had, each room separated from the others by a wooden screen inset with panels of frosted glass. My father drank in the public bar, and I can still recall pushing open the door and being immediately assailed by a welter of sounds and smells. Men's talk, their barks of laughter, thick smoke, beer, sawdust on the bare boards, and in the winter, a small coal fire burning in the grate. Above the mantelpiece, I remember, was a mirror with a black toucan on it, and the words, "Guinness is good for you." I couldn't read the first word. I only knew that something was good for you. There wasn't anything good for me in the public bar of the Dog and Beggar. I'd see him at the bar, his back bent, leaning with his elbows on the counter and one boot up on the brass rail that ran the length of it at ankle height. Someone would say, "Here's Horace's boy," or "Here's your boy, Horace," and I'd see him turn toward me, a cigarette hanging from his lips, and in his eyes there'd be only that cold loathing that came of being reminded again of the fact of his family and the house to which he must return from the careless sanctuary of the public bar. I'd blurt out my message, my little voice piping like a tin whistle among those shuffling, grunting men, those cattle at their beer, and he would tell me to go on back to the house. He'd be along shortly. No one would know, only I, how intense, how venomous was the hatred he felt toward me at that moment, and I'd hurry away as quick as I could. I was never able to tell my mother how much I disliked going into the Dog and delivering her message, for my father disguised his feelings so effectively, she would have laughed to hear me explain what was really going on. When he was in this frame of mind, and drinking only made things worse. Drinking broke down his reserve. Mealtimes were hell. I would sit at the kitchen table, gazing at the ceiling, where an unshaded bulb dangled on the end of a braided brown cord. I tended always to slip into reverie in that poky little kitchen, with its clanging pots and dripping tap and ever-present smell of boiling cabbage. It made those ghastly meals tolerable. Outside, the twilight darkened into night, and from over by the railway embankment came the scream of a whistle as some suburban train went steaming by. My mother put in front of me a plate of boiled potatoes, boiled cabbage, and stewed neck of mutton, the meat coming away from the bone in stringy greyish patches. There was a terrible tension in the room as I picked up my knife and fork. I knew my father was watching me. And this made things worse, for I was a clumsy boy at the best of times, only poorly in control of those long, gangling limbs of mine. I stuffed a large lump of potato in my mouth, but it was too hot, so I had to cough it back onto my plate. "For Christ's sake," he hissed between clenched teeth. My mother glanced at him, her own fork poised over a potato that sat like a plug in a greasy puddle of thin gravy. "Don't lose your temper," she murmured. "It's not the boy's fault." The meal progressed in painful silence. There were no further train noises from over by the railway embankment, nor was there anything moving on Kitchener Street. cutlery clattered on cheap china as we ate our neck of mutton, and the tap dripped into the sink with a steady plop, plop, plop. The bulb overhead continued to spread a sickly yellow light over the room, and having devoured my food, I sat once more gazing at the ceiling with my lips faintly moving, pausing only to pick at a shred of mutton caught between my teeth. "Put the kettle on then, Spider," said my mother, and I rose to my feet. As I did so, I banged one of my kneecaps against the side of the table, jarring it violently, such that my father's plate moved several inches to the left. I felt him stiffen then. I felt his grip tighten on his fork, onto the end of which he had just scraped a soggy pile of pale, limp cabbage. But mercifully, he said nothing. I lit the gas. At last he finished eating, laid his knife and fork across the middle of his plate, placed his hands on the edge of the table, elbows arched outward at a sharp angle, and prepared to get up from the table. "Off down the pub, I suppose," said my mother, still at work on her last potato, which she had cut into a number of very small pieces, and without lifting her eyes to my father's face. I cast a quick, fearful glance at him, and in the way his jaw worked, I knew what he thought of the pair of us, his gangling, useless son and his mutely reproachful wife, who sat there making little pokes and stabs at her potato and refusing to meet his eye. He took his cap and jacket from the hook on the back of the door and went out without a word. The kettle came to the boil. "Make us a nice cup of tea then, Spider," said my mother, rising from her chair and brushing at her cheek as she began to gather the dirty plates.
That was Patrick McGraw reading an excerpt from his novel Spider. His latest book is called Dr. Haggard's Disease. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams has joined us to tell us about All Things Considered today. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Marty. On our program tonight, Elizabeth Arnold reports on the campaign debates this week in Massachusetts between Senator Edward Kennedy and his challenger, Mitt Romney, the issues crime, reform, and experience. Ted Clark has the story of a State Department report to Congress concerning the efforts of an Iranian resistance group trying to overthrow the Iranian government. Charles Murray, the co-author of the book The Bell Curve, defends his thesis that says that IQ plays an important part in determining success. Tom Jelton on the recent victories in Bosnia by the Muslim-led government force. And Bob Garfield on a better life through infomercials.
Thanks, Noah. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. If there's any constant in American cultural life, it's that every year or so, come hell or high water or scandal, Woody Allen will release a new movie. His latest is set in the 1920s among gangsters and hoofers and stars of the Great White Way. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review of Bullets Over Broadway.
What you expect from Woody Allen at his best is huge laughs and a strain of wild originality. What you get in Bullets Over Broadway is neither one. The movie's satire of the theater in the 20s is smooth and rather familiar. The gangsters talk in dems and dozes. Their mauls have big chests and high squeaky voices and mouths full of chewing gum. The great ladies of the theater put on lofty airs. The cinematography by Carlo De Palma is glossy and beautiful, and so are the sets. In short, this is a rather conventional, well-made period comedy. Even so, it's Woody Allen's best movie in years. No, the jokes aren't quite as boffo as his best jokes are, but this isn't a movie of big gags. It's a movie of beautifully built scenes. John Cusack plays the young playwright who thinks of himself as the next Eugene O'Neill. He wants to direct his own new play to make sure it retains its artistic integrity. But integrity goes out the window when the only investor he can attract is a big-time mobster named Nick, who funds the play on the condition that his ambitious but talentless floozy, played to the hilt by Jennifer Tilly, gets a big role. Cusack can't give her the lead. That's already gone to the Grand Dame, played so magnificently by Diane Wiest. But maybe Tilly can portray the psychiatrist. Here she is, running through her lines with her bored and disgusted bodyguard, played by Chaz Palminteri.
Can't you see? You're living out the exact same pattern your mother lived out with your father.
I am? Pray tell.
In some way, you're trying to relive it, and in the process of reliving it, correct it. As if that were possible. Ha!
It don't say ha.
Don't say ha. I added that.
What do you mean you added that?
Are you allowed to do that? We're allowed to add things.
How could you just add something?
You're allowed to add things. It's called ad-libbing.
You can't do that.
I can do that. What do you know? You don't know nothing. Shut up and read.
I think the whole thing stinks,
right? I think you're a degenerate zombie. Shut up and read.
Just shut up.
You shut up.
You're lucky you're Nick's girl.
You're lucky you're an idiot.
Except he's not an idiot. Watching the rehearsals from the audience, the bodyguard suggests a few changes, and they work. So well, in fact, that Cusack himself is in awe. He asks for more, and pretty soon Palminteri is busy ghostwriting, that is, when he's not even busier bumping people off. You can see how much Allen has developed as a dramatic writer in the way he gradually and lovingly reveals these two characters. Palminteri and Cusack develop an almost romantic chemistry. But Allen also knows that no audience now can watch his movies without thinking about the Woody and Mia scandal. One of Cusack's bohemian buddies, played by Rob Reiner, tells him, "An artist creates his own moral universe." And that's what this movie is really about. Cusack, who's nice to everybody, turns out not to have an artistic bone in his body. Palminteri, who's not only morally questionable but a genuine killer, turns out to be a wizard of the theater. That doesn't excuse him, of course, and Allen isn't making excuses here. He doesn't let Palminteri, and by implication himself, off the hook. He's not saying that immorality is okay if you have artistic genius. He's just demonstrating the way the two may coincide. Of all his recent attempts to raise fat moral questions in his work, Bullets Over Broadway is the most well-structured and, in the end, the most satisfying. And, every few minutes, very gently, it also makes you laugh.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham, Joyce Lieberman, Dan Laughlin, and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our intern is Sienna Chrisman. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the highest-ranking officer to challenge the military's anti-gay policy, Colonel Margaret Kammermeyer. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.